Welcome to Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller. One day this summer, a booklet arrived on my desk. It was the kind I like to refer to as a slim but handsome volume. It's called This is the Way We Make Our Baskets by Dorothy and Matthew Titus of Minto. Apparently, the judges for the Alaska State Council on the Arts statewide collaborative art competition also thought the book was quite handsome. They gave it one of the first prizes. The collaborators are the Tituses, organizer Deborah Niedermeyer, photographer Brian Allen, and linguists Jeff Lear and Michael Krause of the Alaska Native Language Center. The book is in English and Athabascan. It serves three purposes. It's a how-to book on making birch baskets, it's a bilingual text, and it's a work of art in its own right. Here are Deborah Niedermeyer and Brian Allen to tell us how the book was made.
Probably, to me, the biggest art of it is the fact that we all worked together, the six of us who worked on this book, work together, and this is just evidence that the art took place, sort of like a dance, I guess.
I think one thing that also should be stressed is the fact that it was pretty much written by Dorothy and Matthew Titus of Minto. We, especially Debbie, sort of facilitated getting it together, but it's a skill that Dorothy has. Interestingly, it's a skill that Dorothy taught herself. It's a self-conscious thing. She did not know how to make baskets when she was a child. She was not taught as a child. And she and a group of other adults from Minto decided that they would like to make baskets. And they'd known that their grandparents had, and some of their parents. And they had a couple of examples lying around.
And they remembered watching their mothers or grandmothers working on them, but they'd never been taught.
And so they very clumsily at first started out to try to make baskets. And it was apparently a very funny and frustrating experience at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think that's partly why Dorothy has had such an enthusiasm for getting the book together.
Right. Her comment when she finally saw the book was that, you know, it would have been a lot easier if I'd had this book.
Going through this book, could somebody pick it up and start on page one and go to page 28 and be able to make a basket?
They'd have to do some seat of the pants. It isn't incredibly detailed. Some things were de-emphasized just because Matthew and Dorothy de-emphasized them, and some things were emphasized. I think you could make a start, and after using it step by step three or four times, you could make a very respectable basket.
Mm-hmm. So the book is what Dorothy and Matthew decided was going to be in the book. It was their decision.
Very definitely. Some, you'll find some things in parentheses. Those are things that I added because Dorothy and Matthew had forgotten them or assumed them so much that as someone who's just coming to it, it was very necessary information for someone who was just coming to it, but it's so obvious to Matthew and Dorothy that they didn't say it. So there are probably five or six short sentences that are in parentheses that I added, or that Matthew, actually, in looking through the initial text, added in English. The text was dictated on a tape recorder.
Yeah, tell me how you did put it together. What are the mechanics of it?
Oh, dear.
Well, there's an awful lot of organizing, and that was mostly Debbie's responsibility, trying to find money for it, trying to get various agencies to back us on it. When we actually got into the field, and probably half the work was already done, and we went down to fish camp with Dorothy and Matthew, and I took photos, and took a lot of photos, probably 800 negatives or so. And
you were there, 4 days?
That time 4 days, I think. And most of the work in making baskets and most of the work in making the book, once we were in the field, was gathering materials and getting photos of that.
The baskets go together pretty quickly, but the finding and splitting of the spruce roots and the finding of the birch bark and gathering that is just very
tedious sometimes.
And timing
it, it's a lot harder to get the bark in certain times of the year. Springtime, late spring is a very good time to gather bark. And so there are all these seasonal things, too, that you have to account for.
So we had this idea even in the middle of winter, but we had to,
wait
and then, jump on it when the time came.
And when the time came, you went to the fish camp and you took the pictures, and then you had them developed, and then what happened?
Well,
Brian
yeah,
developed them.
I developed them and did contact prints. And so then we had this stack of contact prints, and Debbie and I first went through to get photos that were technically adequate, that covered most of the points of basket making. So then we had a pile of prints, and we showed them to Dorothy and Matthew, and they chose from that pile of prints.
We went through the contact sheets. Having learned the process at fish camp ourselves, mm-hmm. and knowing enough to get all the relevant, or most of the relevant pictures, we made...
So you knew the steps that had to be covered. And
right.
You
pretty much.
Took
right.
the best pictures of those steps to
right.
Dorothy and Matthew.
Right. And of course, when they were making the baskets, Sarah was telling us, you know, be sure to get this. And I mean, we weren't hovering around them with cameras the entire 4 days, you know, or tape recorders, as the case may be. And so, you know, we'd be out gathering wood or something, and they'd call us back because they'd gotten to the next step and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. And it was Dorothy who was making the baskets, but Matthew was finding the materials, taking us to the place where the best birch bark was. He was pretty much the boatmaster, mm-hmm. Helping dig roots, splitting roots some, and generally helping us and helping Dorothy be aware of here comes another step.
Yeah. Matthew sounds like the supervisor.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah, and I think he enjoys doing that.
So you had the pictures.
We had a stack of pictures, which we went through and sequenced as best we could. Then Matthew and Dorothy came to town and stayed with us, and we all sat on the floor, and we had them by that time in a notebook.
Yeah, I guess we put them in sequencing, and we'd put them into a notebook.
And they turned the pages and checked it out and checked it out very carefully about 3 or 4 times, made some changes, resequenced things, inserted some blanks and said, look, we need a picture here. Did you get one of those pictures? And then they started by dictating, using the photos, they dictated the text. Almost the photos were almost their notes.
Mm-hmm. So when they came to the photo of pulling a spruce root out of the
right.
ground, they would describe...
This is the way we pull the spruce roots out of the ground, and you look for them. And while they were dictating the text, I was saying, you know, the things that I knew they had remembered to tell me in fish camp when they were right there, hands on spruce roots, sometimes the photograph wasn't good enough to jog their memory, so I would ask, almost interview Dorothy, and say, now, what about the straightness of the roots? Is that important? And mm-hmm. and she would look at me like saying, Debbie, you know that's important. Say it to the tape recorder, Dorothy. You know. So yeah. we got that.
And we tried, well, as we stated before, most of these steps when we were in fish camp. And, of course, splitting spruce roots looks very graceful when Dorothy's doing it, mm-hmm. but when you try it yourself...
You just get little nubs off.
Right, it's very hard to keep them regular.
So, Dorothy dictated the text, and she dictated it in both Athabascan, Minto Athabascan, and English. She found it worked best for her to organize her thoughts in Athabascan, say them, and then give her essentially a translation in English. At which point I transcribed the tape verbatim in English, went over to Alaska Native Language Center. I was working with a village art program. So I went to my coworkers at ANLC and said, look, here's a tape. How'd you like to transcribe it? And they had kind of followed this whole process. And Jeff Lear said, sure. Sat down with the tape, and the tape recorder we used wasn't that hot, and Jeff wasn't that adept at this particular dialect of Athabascan. So it came down to needing Matthew or Dorothy. Matthew came to town, and I think the process that they went through, Jeff and Matthew then, was to, Jeff read to Matthew my verbatim English transcription of Dorothy's text.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew translated that into Minto Athabascan, and he's what the Language Center people call a superb speaker. Jeff, like a secretary, took dictation from Matthew. The writing system was developed by Mike Krause, who also works at ANLC and worked on the writing system in the 60s and did all the linguistic research on the language. So Mike Krause and principally Jeff took dictation from Matthew. Well, they got the dictation, and they realized that, of course, Matthew hadn't Dorothy's verbatim text was not a perfect translation of what Matthew had given them in Minto Athabaskan. So then they had to go and retranslate it so that the translation would be perfectly accurate and the book would be of linguistic use.
So they translated from the English in the book to the Athabaskan.
And then back to the English.
So the English was now going to match the...
Was going to match the Athabaskan, yeah. Right.
I was getting confused.
It got confusing for us, too, for a while.
I guess what we're trying to stress here is besides being a record of basket making and besides being sort of a cross-cultural document, it is a linguistic record, and this is why Alaska Native Language Center was interested in joining in on the project.
So that a student of Athabaskan might be able to...
Exactly.
To learn something from that, of the language,
very
or
much.
Have some
and
fun
how
using
it's used.
It as a...
Yeah.
Right. In fact, we met a high school girl from Minto who's doing some bilingual stuff in her school, and she was able... Using the English and her knowledge of the writing system, she was able to read and figure out what the Athabaskan was saying, and she was really delighted and said that the English had helped her work that way. And one of the things we had in mind was a bilingual textbook that would be interesting.
Yeah, certainly better than Dick and Jane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems to me that if you wanted... something you could use as a textbook, you would not have to go to such great pains to make it look as nice as this does. You could do it with mimeograph sheets and...
Well, that's sort of an insult to the learner. Textbooks should be beautiful, or, it's much more enticing to get into them, and it's like, that's been the problem with textbooks all along. They're boring.
How about Dorothy and Matthew, when they pick up the book and look at it? Have they talked to you about how they feel?
Matthew got a real good look at it. They've seen Dorothy, we've talked to her about the manuscript where we had the pictures and both languages in the text. She was very, very pleased. Matthew, I think, was most interested in seeing his own language written because he's not yet entirely literate in his language. He can read in English and very well. I think he's actually most interested in it as a text. He thinks pretty good.
The book is This is the Way We Make Our Baskets. It's written in Athabaskan and English by Dorothy and Matthew Titus of Minto. We hope to hear from them in a future program. Collaborating on the book were Deborah Niedermeyer, Brian Allen, Jeff Lear, and Michael Krause. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller. This program begins a series of conversations with Pauline Carlo. She lives in Fairbanks, but she grew up in Nulato, and she wrote a book called Nulato and Indian Life on the Yukon. In it, she describes life in the village from the 1920s to the present. She tells of the work of subsistence, the superstitions, beliefs, medicines, celebrations, and ceremonies. It's an account of what she has seen and heard, and it's told in her own words. I went to her house not long ago to talk about the book, her life, and Indian traditions, but to begin with, I wanted to know why she wrote the book in the first place.
It's a long story. Every now and then I would tell my children about how it was living in a village and our Indian customs, and every now and then I'd tell them about this, and one of my boys said, "Mom, why don't you write about your life, And I think that's what started me on the whole thing.
Because your children were interested in your past that
yes.
they got you started.
Mm-hmm. It is a wonderful, wonderful past life. The way we used to live in the villages, no rushing, no worry about time. It was just a day-to-day life, beautiful life.
Are you sad to see that go?
I sure do when I think back, because that's something no one can ever take away from me. It's a beautiful memory, and it's a sad thing that a lot of my people, I mean the younger people, never did live that type of life, because I think it's just a wonderful, clean life.
And there was enough to do in the village. Your life was full, even though...
Yes, it was. Because we had our work and our play. And it's just a community, you know. It seemed like there was always something going on. And like, as I said, at Nularo, it seemed like it was the hub of that area. Because whenever there was any marriages or... any baptisms to give or something, they always went to Nularo for such things, and it was always a little celebration, you know, and we just looked forward to that, and everybody just took part and really enjoyed themselves. And you know, teenagers never thought of drinking. We never knew what drinking was at that time. The older folks now and then, but it was very seldom that they did, you know. And that just never entered our mind. We had dances, and you didn't have to get high in order to just enjoy yourself. But going back to the book, I think what pleased me very much after I wrote the book and after it came out was that so much of the... things that have been written about the Indians seems like there's never anything good written about. The Caucasian always finds the bad part about a native to write about, even take pictures of. You know, they never seem to try to get the best part of a person. It's always the down, the low, you know. And therefore, I think just writing the book about how life was really kind of paid off for what the others have written about. To me, that was the satisfaction that I got out of that book.
What I got out of the book, in part, was a feeling for what traditional village life was like and how it's changed. The book takes the reader through the oldest, now long forgotten customs to the way traditional beliefs and Christian religion have merged. The first chapter is about a woman growing up in Nularo. Pauline writes that when a girl becomes a young woman, she was put away for a year. She was made to stay behind a curtain in the cabin where she slept and ate alone. She was not allowed to eat fresh meat or berries. During that time, she was learning the things she needed to know when she was married, something her parents arranged for her when her time was up. It's a custom the younger generation doesn't know very much about, and it's certainly no longer practiced.
In fact, the last person that I remember as a little girl that was like that was Vivian Peters, and she's still alive down in Nularo. She must be in her 70s, early 70s, I guess. But I remember her and this other lady, Eva, were both that way, and I used to always sneak in there and lift up the curtain and lay on my stomach, you know, and they'd have this coal oil lamp, kerosene lamp, you know, in there, and I'd talk with them, and they were always so happy to have someone come to talk with them, you know.
They were
but
behind,
I remember that,
behind a curtain
all
for a
the
year.
Time,
Are you glad you didn't go through that, or would you...
I don't think I would have, really, because it was just... too much.
But your mother did.
My mother did, yes.
Did she talk about it?
Well, she died when I was 9 years old, so, you know, my dad died when I was two.
Did your grandmother?
Grandmother talked about it, yeah. So when I got that way, well, she talked to Grandpa about it, about putting me away, and he said, no, we won't, because we lost our girls. And she said they went through all that suffering for, you know, and said, we're not going to do that to our grandchildren.
And it was suffering.
Well, there was, you know, it had to be, you know, you're just back there with no one. And for a whole year, you couldn't do things you wanted to do.
And that was something that was based purely on superstition?
Well, I don't know, superstition, I don't know. It was a way of life for the people. I don't think, I don't know.
Maybe it's the wrong word. Maybe
I think it is the wrong word, because like I always say about, you know, our Catholic people, I mean, they came up in the early years and told us our ways of life, like our medicine people and such, were wrong, that it was the devil's, you know. Well, who were they to tell us our ways of life was wrong? No more than I could tell you that your ways and your beliefs are wrong because I didn't believe in it, mm-hmm. You know. It's not right.
So it's more just a way of always doing things.
It's just a way of, like, say, endurance. I don't know if that would be more appropriate word for it instead of saying superstitions, I think, because I think it's to prepare you of the tough way of life ahead, or, you know.
It had a function, uh-huh. A real purpose.
It was. So, in a sense, I don't think it was superstitions, really.
For the traditional beliefs, superstition isn't the right word, but is religion the right word? Is it really a religion, the kind of thing you were talking about? Some of the I guess you'd say taboos were say a woman couldn't sleep with her husband when he was trapping beaver.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that part of a religion, or is it a superstition, or is it neither?
Well, it isn't religion by no means. It is our Indian belief. You know, that's long before the white man ever came up here, you know, that's the Indian Indian belief. But still, again, on the other hand, it is sort of right from wrong,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Which is the basis of religion.
Which is based on religion itself.
Mm-hmm. And
our belief was, if you did wrong in your life, that you're going to have to suffer for it after death, you know. So where did that come from before the white man ever came up here? Same way with our Indian songs. I think some of them are just beautiful. The words that are put into our Indian songs are beautiful for a person that would understand it. It's just a heart-meaning thing, you know. And there's the verse and then the chorus in between and then another verse and chorus. Well, and then a lot of times even in the Indian words, the words rhyme. Well, how did that come about? You know, where did that come from? I often think about that because, and then too, we carry a lot of our Indian songs from way back, and the words that are in those songs, you have to be smart in order to figure out what those words mean, because they are higher words than I would use. And if you're smart, even though the person didn't finish the sentence, you're supposed to figure out for yourself just what he's talking about. He doesn't have to just go on and explain every little thing. You know, you have to.
Kind of like what poetry does.
You know, you don't go all the way through to explain the thing, but. You know, you cut it short, but the whole meaning is right there itself.
One of the phrases in the parts of the book that I liked best when you talked about some of the love songs that the men would sing in the boats.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Do you remember those?
Oh yes.
Can you sing any of them, or do you?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. This here was a love song. We call the name of it is Eagle Island, and it was made by a man from Nulato that was out on a trap line, and one evening, I guess he started thinking about his girlfriend, and he got so lonesome for home that he just composed this song. I don't have the voice for it, but I can try anyway. Eagle Island, lesto o de huno, nulato. Good time, hulan doch ni. Sida adze yose adotonil de hon de godet ni ana one oni. Anna one, Anna one, oh no. Yeltsar, yeltkosh, Anna one, one. We used to waltz in that song years, years ago. This is about over 40 years old.
Pauline Carlo with a song we could still waltz to. In the next program, we'll hear more about the traditional Indian beliefs and life in Nulato. For Chinook Profiles, I'm Paula Schiller, and Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.